But that Kaleidoscope program was the only one you've done. You've never done any other.
I did. I then did some things for him on a program called Word.
One to start with, yeah.
So the light isn't working, but...
Okay.
The light. Yeah? Mm. Well, Frank, perhaps we could start with, I mean, the most general question of all, in a way, which is, why does a health service matter, do you think? What is it an indication of in terms of social arrangements?
Well, in almost any society, medical services are obviously terribly important because they can be a matter of life or death. So that of all the services that one secures or obtains from a society, medical care is, and health care generally, is among the most important. Now, in addition to that, throughout the Western world, particularly now, we find that health care costs are rising at a very rapid rate, and they are straining resources. And therefore, we have to search in some way in which we can provide medical care for everyone because they're so vital without unduly straining the economy. Now, it seems to me that a hallmark of a civilized society is a society that does make medical care freely available to everyone, that does not make it based on ability to pay. And in this respect, the National Health Service of Great Britain leads the world. I mean, there is no other medical care system anywhere, not even in the Soviet Union, that provides as comprehensive a service as one can obtain here in Britain. And the interesting thing is, not only is it a hallmark of a civilized society, but it happens to be pretty cheap. In fact, it's too cheap. I mean, Britain is fortunate in the respect that it can not only be humane, but has managed to evolve a particular type of medical care system that ranks among the lowest cost in the world. To give you just an example between two major nations, my own country, America. In America now, medical care costs, and medical care there is provided mainly through private provision. Medical care costs now are about 10% of gross national product, whereas in Britain, they're only about 6%. So what can one can say most of all about the health service, it's civilized and it's cheap.
Could you tell us then something about how it came into being? What are its historical roots, particularly in the 19th century, and what sort of services did it seek to improve on?
Well, the health service, as you know, began in 1948. The act was passed in 1946. But I don't think that that act ever would have been put on the book had there not been a previous act enacted in 1911 called the National Insurance Act, which was introduced by David Lloyd George. And I think the starting point for understanding the evolution of the health service, how and why it came on the statute book, one has to look very closely at that act in 1911, because that act provided a rudimentary general practitioner service for the nation, for the a large proportion of the nation. It covered nearly all the working class and some part of other classes as well. Before it ended, it covered half the population of the nation, roughly half. And it provided only general practitioner care. It didn't provide hospital and specialist care. But that act covered a substantial proportion of the profession, and it got the profession used to working within a state system. The system that developed then was called the panel system. And the doctors at first resisted its introduction, but they got to like it. They got comfortable with panel care. They didn't see the state as some fearful bogey. So that when the 1946-48 period came along, although again they opposed the particular details and elements, they had been used to working within the framework of the state system, and therefore it did not put the bulk of the profession off as it might have done and as it did in other countries. Now, okay, if the 1911 Act was the starting point, we then have got to understand how and why did that 1911 Act get on the books. Now, that 1911 Act was based, as far as its medical side is concerned, on club practice started by friendly societies in the 19th century. So I think the proper starting point for tracing the evolution of the National Health Service is to go back to the 19th century, look very closely at the arrangements the friendly societies made with the doctors, and see how evolution took place from that point.
Well, tell us more about that then. Who initiates the changes that will become, as it were, the 1911 Act from those friendly society roots?
Well, the Friendly Society started their medical care system mainly as an adjunct for paying cash sickness benefits. They would pay for all the members of the society. Whenever they got sick, they'd pay them a small weekly allowance for most of the term of the illness. In fact, there were long-term benefits as well. And they needed to have some means of checking that their member was really ill. So they got a doctor to act as the check. He issued a certificate, which still happens today. The state still uses the doctor to certify that a person is ill. So they persuaded, more than that, some doctors actually wanted to participate in it, because for them it was a means of getting assurance of income. And while they worked for the Friendly Society, they had a assured group of patients they could count on. And in the 19th century, when medical science had really very, very little to offer, it was in a rather infant state. A doctor couldn't offer so much more over a naturopath or a chiropractor or an osteopath. Club practice provided a refuge for doctors from the threat of unqualified competition. So as the century progressed, it grew and it grew and it grew, and it started with professional, with medical concurrence, interest, enthusiasm, but it got to the point where it went beyond the limits that the profession considered desirable. Now, the reason for that was that the pay set for club doctors was very low. It was set at the over 4 shillings per patient a year. And out of that 4 shillings, the doctor had to provide out of his own pocket all the drugs that the patient needed. So that as new drugs came on the market, as the 19th century progressed and spilling over in the early 20th century, as new drugs came on, the doctors found it more and more difficult to live within this 4 shilling limit. And the friendly societies, for the most part, refused to raise it. I mean, when club practice began early in the 19th century, the rate was slightly lower. It was about 2 or 3 shillings. But by the time the National Insurance Act was introduced in 1911, it still had only risen to about 4 shillings. Now, in addition to that, the doctors felt they were overworked. Some friendly societies even interfered with clinical treatment. There's one doctor who worked for the clubs in Birmingham who reported in The Lancet that while he was there, he was allowed only 1 minute to see patients, and if he exceeded that time, a loud knocking on his surgery door brought the consultation to a close. So the profession disliked the way they were treated by the friendly societies. They did not control the medical arrangements. Friendly societies were groups of working men, mainly skilled working men, artisans, who came together, clubbed together to provide this rudimentary insurance system. But they kept control within their hands. Now, beginning about 1895, the profession had been living with this thing, with this service, from about the 1820s or so. And they felt the time had come for reform. They could no longer live with these low fees. And something happened called the Battle of the Clubs, a struggle between the doctors on one side and the friendly societies on another, with the doctors trying to alter club practice, trying to raise their rates, to alter the whole management structure, to reduce the coverage of the friendly societies. And at first, the doctors, the British Medical Association at the time, was not very responsive to the desires of club doctors in this respect. It was pretty much under the control of the leading specialists and consultants of the land, and they weren't involved so much in club practice, and they did not respond to the general practitioner demands for reform. So rather than work through the BMA, which was not responsive to them, the club doctors formed local medical trade unions. And these grew up during the 1890s. But the doctors soon realized that local action was not enough. They could conduct a medical strike against the friendly societies in one community, but they would find doctors coming in from another community to fill the posts that they had boycotted, they had struck against. So they saw the need for a national trade union, and they then began to focus their attention on the British Medical Association and try and transform it into something like a viable national trade union. And in the year 1902, the constitution of the BMA was reformed, and therefore between 1902 and 1911, the doctors tried to use the BMA, the British Medical Association, as a means of breaking the Friendly Society hold over club practice. Now, the victory in 1902 was only a partial victory. They weren't able to get all the powers that they needed. They couldn't raise compulsory strike levies and pay adequate strike benefits. So the BMA failed as a vehicle, and local trade union action failed. The doctors were not able to use this type of pressure group, trade union action, through private means to break the hold of the friendly societies. So finally, they were very fortunate in having Lloyd George come along with a national insurance system in 1911. And when that bill was introduced, originally medical control was left in the hand of the friendly societies. Lloyd George found it very difficult to alter that arrangement, although he personally wanted to do so, because the friendly societies were so strong. And it wasn't until after the bill was introduced into Parliament that the doctors were able to wrest control from the friendly societies and transfer it to another unit of administration set up under the Act.
That's very interesting. The question that springs from it is that you already convey a sense that what you call the doctors are in some sense divided amongst themselves. In other words, the interests of the general practitioner, an interest that seems to involve bringing in the state to improve the conditions of general practice, isn't necessarily an interest shared by senior doctors, i.e. consultants and others. So would you say that in the 1911 Act there was already a contradiction within the profession as to who was pleased that the state was now involved and who wasn't?
It's very difficult to talk, as you pointed out, in general terms about the doctors. I mean, there are so many different types of doctors and so many conflicting interests within the medical profession. As you indicated, these consultants and specialists tended to have different interests from the general practitioners, and general practitioners who weren't terribly dependent on club practice had different interests from those who were dependent. The driving force within the medical profession behind the need to use the state to break friendly society hold came from those doctors who were deeply dependent on club practice. Now, at the time in Britain, there were roughly 20,000 doctors participating in general practice. Some of them were part-time specialists. The profession wasn't as purely divided as it is today, clearly divided. So there are roughly 20,000 general practitioners, and roughly half of them, maybe 10,000, were under contract in one form or another with friendly societies and other types of club organizations. But the doctors who were most interested in breaking the friendly society hold were the doctors who came from the industrial areas of Britain, mainly in the north, around in Yorkshire and Lancashire. And they were about 4,000 or 5,000 of them, as far as one can tell. And they were the ones, it was their leaders who spearheaded this reform of the BMA. I can mention two names, Dr. James Smith Whitaker, so he became Sir James Smith Whitaker, and Dr. Alfred Cox. They were the medical secretary and the deputy of the BMA in the Edwardian era. And they were the two leaders of the BMA who spearheaded this reform. Now, if you want to see most clearly where their interests centered and where they were driving for, you have to look at a statement made in Parliament by a member of Parliament when the National Insurance Bill was passing through, when it was being debated. On August the 1st, 1911, there was a very crucial amendment debated. That amendment called for the transfer of medical benefit from the control of the friendly societies to a new health committee. And the doctors were very anxious to have this medical control transferred to this new health committee. So what did they do? Now, the doctors had fairly close ties with some of the labor leaders at the time, but they didn't go to one of the labor members of Parliament. They chose a very conservative member of Parliament named Sir Henry Craik, who, if you want to understand his political and economic views, you have to think his only counterpart today would be somebody like Arthur Seldon of the Institute of Economic Affairs. He believed in the operation of the marketplace purely and solely, and within the social services as well as in the economy generally. Now, Craik was a very ultra-conservative MP who believed in the friendly societies, who disliked socialism and whatnot, yet he stood up in Parliament on August the 1st, 1911, and made this plea. And if you permit me, I'd like to read out just what he said on that date, because it's probably the most important statement in the whole history of the development of the health service. He said, if you do not now place the administration of the medical relief, he meant medical benefit, under some public body, such as the local health committee, you will place the profession of medicine in perpetuity under the heel of private societies. However good they may be, the friendly societies are, after all, private societies. You must place them, meaning the doctors, under some public body. The very fact that it is a public body secures permanency, public respect, a just tribunal in case of dispute, and I shall also say, secures a high standard of professional honor. And aus from this important field of public beneficence, any man who would lower the standard of that professional honor and therefore undermine the foundations of public health. It is only by a public body you can maintain proper discipline, that you can impose a proper standard, and that you can insist upon full publicity being given to every transaction in which the public is concerned. Leave it, he says, leave it to the private concerns, the friendly societies, however good they are. And as long as human nature remains what it is, they must be affected by financial considerations. They cannot be responsible to the public in the same way as a public representative body is. Their administration will inevitably diminish public confidence and lower the security which you ought to give to the public. And then he says, I am speaking in no narrow interests of the profession. I am speaking, I am perfectly convinced, in the interests of the public health. The doctors desire, and surely it is a fair, reasonable, and just claim that they put forward, the doctors desire, he says, to be brought into immediate contact with the state, whose servants they are. They desire to be no intermediary in the shape of any private body, however advantageous it may be, or however praiseworthy its efforts and its work may be, and however many and beneficial its actions may be. Now,
well, that's very interesting, and that is, as it were, part of the prehistory of the question, if you see what I mean, since in the public mind, understandably, it is 1948 that is some origin, although you've illuminated very interestingly that that actually isn't the case. But could you briefly say something about the history between the Lloyd George Act and the post-war events, since the degree of conflict that we conventionally regard as having occurred in those years seems far more pronounced than these very interesting, yes, almost shared opinions, yes, that you've told us about. So what happens in that, mm, in that,
well,
period?
Well, the Insurance Act goes through with this amendment, and the friendly societies lose control, and the control of medical benefit is put in the hands of a unit of administration called the Insurance Committee, which in 1948 becomes the Executive Council, and when the Health Service was reorganized in 1974, becomes the Family Practitioner Committee. So the Family Practitioner Committee, which exists today, is the direct descendant of the Insurance Committee, which was created in 1911, 1912. Now, this Insurance Committee, Lloyd George would almost certainly have liked to give the doctors greater control and say over their lives in 1911-12, but he was faced with very difficult political pressures, conflicting pressures. And before that bill went through, he had to give the approved societies, and the approved societies at this time, into the Act came not only the friendly societies, but trade unions and industrial insurance corporation companies and collecting societies, the whole group. But those were the three main groups, the insurance companies, the friendly societies, and the trade unions. They formed what were called approved societies. And Lloyd George gave them a 60% majority on the insurance committee, had to, in order to get the Act through. Now, the doctors felt that that was almost like putting them back under the heel of the friendly societies again, and that accounts for, mainly accounts for, the very strong opposition they put up in 1912. Now, there were another of other factors built into the Act, which are rather complex, too much to go into, but the Act had within it certain conditions which led to conflict between the doctors and the approved societies, and there was a series of conflicts that ensued from 1912, building up to a climax about 1923-24, when there was rather a climactic battle between the doctors and the proof societies, and the doctors emerged victorious from that battle. And then right after that came a Royal Commission on National Health Insurance, which threw the societies on the defensive because the tenor of its report was it was calling for the extension of state provision without it being financed on the insurance principle. It was leaning more and more towards the type of general revenue finance that we have today, that we got in 1948. And the approved society system, the friendly societies and so forth, they depended on the preservation, really, of the insurance principle to preserve themselves. So what happened is that by the 20s, with this victory, by the mid-20s, with this victory of the doctors in the 1923-24 dispute, plus the Royal Commission report, the societies were thrown on the defensive. And from that point onwards, going on through the 30s, medical influence over administration increases year by year. And the doctors then began to feel more and more comfortable within the framework of the national insurance system, and they didn't worry so much about whether the approved societies were going to be preserved or not. Before then, until 24, they really wanted the approved societies out of the way, and they wanted a contract directly with the state, directly with the Ministry of Health. But then what happens in the 1930s, a new threat looms as far as the profession is concerned, and that's the development of public health services under municipal control, under local authorities. And these were full-time salaried services run by what the doctors considered a whole-time medical bureaucrat they distrusted, the medical officer of health. And these services tended to cover and provide care to those people who had been excluded from the 1911 Insurance Act. The 1911 Insurance Act covered, for the most part, well, it only covered people who were at work. The dependents of those people, the wives and children of insured persons, were excluded. And this local authority provision began to gather pace between the wars, covering more and more of such people. And the type of system used was a salaried service. Now, the doctors did not want to escape to get out from under approved society, friendly society control, only to be thrust into the hands of a municipal service. So the main problem between the wars as far as the medical profession was concerned, if the extension of state provision was coming, and it seemed to be coming from various pressure from various sources, the doctors wanted it to come in such a form so that they would be subject to the least type of rigorous administrative control.
And therefore, is it the case that the act that eventually appears between 46 and 48 is unsatisfactory to them from that point of view? Is that the root of some of the conflict?
Oh, not at all. The act that emerged in 48 was ideal, virtually ideal as far as the profession is concerned, because the approved societies were eliminated in 1948. The Ministry of National Insurance Department took over instead. So they had a state body that they could deal with on that side. And the approved societies were also eliminated from these insurance committees, executive councils, now family practitioner committees. And the doctors were able to exert great influence on how these new bodies operated through their local medical committees, so that under the health service, both the general practitioners and the consultants managed to secure a great deal of influence over the way the act was administered.
That is extremely interesting. It seems from your account then that the doctors benefited enormously throughout the century from the various inroads into state support that were being made. Why then do we have in the common imagination a sense that, particularly in regard to the BMA, the thing was a battle?
Because each time the profession was confronted with an actual plan, an actual bill, the actual provisions, they did not like what they saw, and they complained about the details. Although for the years prior to the time that these bills were introduced, both in 1911 and again in 1946, there had been pressures within the profession pushing for state intervention to free themselves from private insurance or municipal services. When they actually got presented with the plan that was given to them, they didn't like the looks of it. Now, this was particularly, this was true in 1911, of course. Lloyd George let the bill go through with the friendly societies in control when it was introduced. And he, as I mentioned before, he couldn't get it through without giving the societies a 60% majority. Well, again, in 1943, when the Department of Health presents the profession with a plan for a National Health Service, the very first plan they present is one in which the local authorities control and run the service. It was going to be a full-time salaried service under local authority control. And this produced an uproar in the profession. And it was very hard for the ministry at that point to backtrack and alter the system to satisfy the doctors. And therefore, we had this from 1943 right down to 1948. We had this battle with the doctors saying, no, no, we dislike this and this.
So it seems then that the question of the origins of this service and the conflicts it's generating are to do with the doctor's specific regard for details at each particular historical moment. They have a quibble with the details. What is interesting about this account is it tends to make the doctor's requirements, and indeed those requirements being met, of far more historical importance than, say, the Beveridge Report, or even possibly a general socialist commitment within the political sphere. That what we're really talking about is a hard bargain being struck by doctors to get state support to free them from various shackles, and we're not necessarily talking about the influence of political ideologies or, as it were, reports in general.
I think that's certainly true. There was this main current, as I've described it, of the profession pushing to use state intervention to free itself from difficulties under private medical care systems or municipal systems. That was the main undercurrent. And everything else was rather peripheral. All the other ideologies and groups that worked sort of caught hold of that current and gave it a push forward. But if that basic predisposition had not been there, I doubt very much whether Britain would have had a National Health Service. There had to be this medical predisposition towards state intervention.
So in some important sense, the origins of the service cannot be attributed to a political and, in this case, socialist thrust. It is historically generated by the interests of doctors.
Well, I think that's the basic point. There certainly was a socialist thrust. There were socialist groups, Socialist Medical Association and other socialist groups working to push, and they pushed the current along. But if that current had not been moving in that direction, if it had been flowing in the opposite direction, I don't think these socialist groups could have given it the push. The tide would have been too strong against them.
So in that sense, the doctors call the tune, you might say, in historical terms. Since the Act itself and the historical struggles that it generated, what has happened within the service, do you think, to reflect these doctoral interests? I mean, doctors from your account could, for example, suddenly turn against it. It might no longer be the vehicle for their particular forms of advantage. It might be that a particular growth in private practice would suddenly be, for historical reasons, far more lucrative or whatever. So do you think that some of the difficulties within the service since the war have been to do with doctors being able to change their minds about what is now to their advantage as against what was once to their advantage?
Well, I think we're now in a totally different political situation as far as medical politics are concerned. I mean, through state intervention, the extension of the health service, when it was created in 1948, the doctors freed themselves from approved society control on the one hand and from local authority threat on the other. And certainly this was completed in 1974 when the medical officer of health was finally removed entirely from the scene. So we have a situation today in which the doctors no longer have these external threats. They feel very comfortable within the framework of a state system. But what's happened is that the state system has unfortunately failed to deliver the economic goods. It hasn't provided the profession and the public with the financial resources it needs in order to keep abreast of developments of modern medicine. And the profession is becoming extremely restive, and I think justly so. The public ought to be restive too, much more restive than it is, about the inadequate resources devoted to health care.
Does that difficulty not therefore reflect what you have to call a wider question? I mean, you might relate it to the mixed economy, to the absence of a full-scale socialist program in education as well as health services, and that the funding that's going into the National Health Service, insufficient in your account, reflects the mixed nature of the economic system as it's inherited down from the pre-war period, and that in that sense the crisis of the service is a crisis within the state as to how to fund public services in general, that they are too expensive within a mixed economy and therefore always falling away.
Well, what's, as I said when I initially began, we began this interview, that the British National Health Service is one of the cheapest in the world. And the thing, what we have to understand is you cannot avoid expenses on medical care, whether it's provided through private or public means. People need medical care in order to cure themselves of illness and disease and get well. Now, as I said, in America, where we have a predominantly private system, medical care costs 10% of gross national product. Now, okay, you can lessen the burden on budgetary considerations by removing medical care costs from the budget and providing it through private means. But the nation as a whole still has to put up money. And in America, we see that it costs much more, and in other countries of the world aside from America, costs much more to provide the people with medical care. So the health service is a cheap way of providing it.
But isn't the analogy with America, which is an interesting one, precisely as follows, that if in regard to, say, what you have to pay for drugs, you're paying bills to private companies, companies which can dictate prices on what they deem a market rate, certainly true of America and, of course, Great Britain, that the health service is, as it were, paying out of the public funds.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But the main point I'm trying to make is that the health service does not make inordinate demand on public resources. It does not make a sufficient demand. And if the country is going to provide medical care, the cheapest way to do it is through public sources. Now, public means. Now, the main reason why the health service has come out in this underfinanced way is because there isn't the constituency pressure for health expenditure that there is in other fields of public endeavor. Housing, education, roads, all these, and pension benefits, all these other means of state provision seem to have stronger constituencies pushing for higher expenditure, and members of parliament and members of the government respond more to constituency pressure. So the main reason why the health service has not come out well is we have not had sufficient pressure coming from below on politicians to get them to provide more money, although it would be the most economical way of doing it.
So one final question then. What would be your brief account of why there is a crisis within the service? In other words, why it seems to be not reaching the people for whom it was originally intended, that is to say, the mass of the working people of this country. Something is going amiss. The dominance of private interest seems considerable. How, given your very particular view of its historical inception, would you account for the current crisis?
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think the health service isn't meeting the needs of the masses of the people. It's meeting the needs of the masses. Everyone is still covered. Everyone get access to medical care. Waiting lists may be somewhat longer in some places for some types of difficulties. But the health service still is fulfilling its basic function. But the fabric is running down. The capital fabric is running down. The hospitals are getting older and older. And they're cracking in some places. There was an article in the Sunday Times only last weekend about one community in which the walls of the hospital are starting to fall apart. And we desperately need more money to keep this service going. And I think that is the great danger for the health service coming up in the 1980s and the 1990s. We've got to find some means. The country has to find some means to adequately fund it through public means. If it doesn't, then there probably will be a increasing growth of the private sector.
But just to finish, that must mean that the interests that brought it to life in the first place are no longer as committed to its maintenance as they once historically were. That in that sense, it no longer serves the interests of the groups who you describe as having pushed for it via state support in the first place.
I think that's true, that the doctors no longer have the vested interest in state intervention. They no longer need the protection that it would provide. On the other hand, as far as general practitioners are concerned, I have my real doubts whether general practice would survive in the form in which it's in now if it didn't have this type of state system that we have in which doctors are paid by a capitation payment. I could see, for example, over the next 20, 30 years, if the health service were dismantled and general practitioners were left to compete with one another for clients among the public, they would in turn become part-time specialists like doctors in America and Germany and elsewhere, and the general practitioner corps wouldn't be preserved. So if there's any group that ought to recognize that it has a vested interest in the preservation of the National Health Service, it is the General Practitioner Corps of Great Britain.
Thanks very much.
What is interesting about what you're saying is that it runs against certain other accounts of the history of this service in the sense that it places a rather fascinating emphasis on the degree of agreement between state and doctors and other parties which bring this thing into life. Could you say something about how unions felt about, as it were, the British Medical Association, and whether or not your model, which is, as it were, collusive rather than conflict-bound, doesn't have certain rather interesting things to say about groups who one might assume to be in opposition, unions and medical organizations, in fact sharing this similar commitment?
Well, I mean, I see the health service emerging as a result of the clash of vested interests, but there was a convergence of interest between two groups which seem rather strange to us today. And these two groups were the doctors on the one hand and the trade unions on the other. Now let me try to explain how this alliance emerged. The trade unions were admitted to the Insurance Act as approved societies along with the friendly societies and the industrial insurance offices. But they didn't do very well in organizing the insured persons into their approved societies. They ended up with less than 10% of the total. And they really got weaker and weaker over the years. So they lost out the organizing race. Now, in addition to that, the unions were very concerned about the way an allied social insurance system was working between the wars. This was called workman's compensation. Today, we have an Industrial Injuries Act, which supplanted it in 1946. It's the system whereby workers who are injured at work, who are disabled as a result of work accidents or who contract some type of industrial disease, get compensation. Well, before 1948, throughout the whole pre-war period, interwar period, they were compensated through an act called the Workmen's Compensation Act, which was administered by employers in conjunction with insurance companies. And the unions felt that that act was not administered very fairly. What really stuck in their throat was this lump sum payment, which employers and insurance companies tried to persuade workers to accept, and they tried to get them to accept inadequate lump sums rather than take an annuity or benefit per week for as long as the disability lasted, in some cases to their lives. They tried to settle it in as niggardly amount as possible. And the unions felt that the employers and insurance companies were trying to use the doctors and the voluntary hospitals where they disabled workers would get medical care to try and force settlements. Now, I'm not suggesting that this actually did happen, but that it's impossible today to determine just what the insurance companies and employers did during that period. It's possible that they were trying to force lump sums, inadequate lump sum settlements. I don't know. But what we are concerned with, as far as history is concerned, is what were the beliefs that molded union policy. The unions believed that the Workmen's Compensation Act was being maladministered, and therefore they wanted to remove the insurance companies from the operation of that act, and they also wanted to get the industrial insurance companies out of the operation of the National Insurance Act, because they tended to dominate that act as well. The unions wanted to eliminate the insurance industry, the private insurance industry, from its involvement in social insurance. And they came together with the doctors who had these other interests, which I mentioned earlier, in the mid-1930s, they formed a joint committee, a joint BMA Trade Union Congress Committee, BMA-TUC Committee, which began to hammer very hard jointly on workmen's compensation themes. And they forced the creation of a Royal Commission on Workmen's Compensation in 1938. And that commission had on it some leading trade union and labor figures. And the commission began holding hearings, and the unions were hopeful that something good would come out of it. When along came the war, and 1940, the employers used the war as an excuse to boycott the hearings, and the commission suspended its hearings. And the unions were furious because they didn't get what they wanted. And they then put pressure on, and the result was a beverage committee was put in its place, and out came the beverage report with its famous assumption that a health service would be created as an adjunct. But it was this joint BMA-TUC pressure that produced that Royal Commission on Workmen's Compensation, which in turn produced the beverage report, which in turn produced the welfare state. So in some strange way, we see the unions and the doctors being the main pressure groups forcing a creation of a welfare state in 1946-48. Today, of course, it's entirely different. We now have a split between these interests. The unions now, many of the unions, or some of some of the health service unions certainly, and other and the official trade union Congress policy, is to eliminate private practice from the health service, to root it out completely. Whereas we know the doctors today want to preserve it, and in some cases even extend it, because they do not want to see themselves becoming whole-time servants to state or too utterly dependent on state provision. So now, whereas we had an alliance between the unions and the doctors in the 1930s, today we have conflict between them as far as that's concerned.